This is the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel, Stone Mountain, in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the book of Deuteronomy. Today on Sandy Adams Radio, Pastor Sandy will be teaching in Deuteronomy chapter 24.
Well, these next few verses deal with a situation where a man accuses his wife of false advertising, basically, of saying that she's a virgin when in reality she's not. He says, "Then the father and the mother of the young woman shall take and bring out the evidence of the young woman's virginity to the elders of the city at the gate." What was this evidence? Well, on their wedding night, it was customary for the newlyweds to lay a cloth under them so that it collected the few drops of blood that were created by the woman's initial intercourse. This was then given to the parents as proof of the woman's virginity. Now today, gynecological exams and the fact that women marry at much later ages make this an impractical test. But in ancient times, the new brides could be 13, 14, sometimes even younger. And so this proved to be a reliable test of a woman's virginity. It's interesting, there are places in the Middle East, even to this day, where this custom is still observed. Now, if she's accused, the bride's parents bring out this evidence of virginity, the cloth. And the young woman's father shall say to the elders, "I gave my daughter to this man as wife, and he detests her. Now he has charged her with shameful conduct, saying, 'I found your daughter was not a virgin, and yet these are the evidences of my daughter's virginity.' And they shall spread the cloth before the elders of the city. Then the elders of that city shall take that man and punish him." In other words, the man had lied in an attempt to gain a divorce from his wife. "And they shall fine him 100 shekels of silver, and they'll give them to the father of the young woman because he has brought a bad name on a virgin of Israel." You see how God valued virginity? He says, "And she shall be his wife. He cannot divorce her all his days." Verse 20. "But if the thing is true and evidences of virginity are not found for the young woman, then they shall bring out the young woman to the door of her father's house, and the men of her city shall stone her to death with stones because she has done a disgraceful thing in Israel to play the harlot in her father's house. So you shall put away the evil from among you." And you say, God takes premarital sex lightly? That's not what these verses tell me. Now, if a man is found lying with a woman married to a husband, then both of them shall die. The man that lay with the woman and the woman, so you shall put away the evil from Israel. Two people caught in the act of adultery both deserved the death penalty. And this is why the episode in John chapter 8 is so suspicious. You remember the woman taken in adultery that they threw at Jesus' feet? She was taken in the very act. Well, if so, where was her partner? Last I checked, it takes two to commit adultery. According to the law, both the man and the woman was stoned, but on that day, they only delivered the woman. It's likely that she was the victim of a Pharisaical setup. Verse 23 tells us, "If a young woman who is a virgin is betrothed to a husband, and a man finds her in the city and lies with her, then you shall bring them both out to the gate of that city, and you shall stone them to death with stones, the young woman because she did not cry out in the city, and the man because he humbled his neighbor's wife, so you shall put away the evil from among you." Now, the fact that the woman didn't cry out implies that the sex was consensual. It was not a rape. "But if a man finds a betrothed young woman in the countryside, and the man forces her and lies with her, then only the man who lay with her shall die. But you shall do nothing to the young woman. There is in the young woman no sin deserving of death. For just as when a man rises against his neighbor and kills him, even so is this matter. For he found her in the countryside, and the betrothed young woman cried out, but there was no one to save her." In this case, it's rape. And rape is not the woman's fault. She should be comforted, not condemned. And thus God punishes the man, but then brings comfort to the woman. Now, if a man finds a young woman who is a virgin, who is not betrothed, and he seizes her and lies with her, and they are found out, and again, the implication here is that it's consensual, then the man who lay with her shall give to the young woman's father 50 shekels of silver, and she shall be his wife because he has humbled her. He shall not be permitted to divorce her all his days. Now, here's the case of two people who have premarital sex. They are to marry. But notice this. When does the woman become the man's wife? When they have sex? No, not at all. They become husband and wife when the man pays her father the bridal price. This was the procedure by which people in ancient times entered marriage. Don't tell me that just because you live with this person and that you've had sex with her, then you're married in God's eyes. I've heard that a million times. The Bible is clear. In God's eyes, you're not married. In fact, God doesn't recognize two people as being married until the bridal price is paid. Or, in essence, the legalities are completed. And whatever those legalities happen to be, based on that culture at that time, are what constitutes a marriage in God's eyes. In that day, it was the payment of a bridal price. In our day, it means standing before an official and exchanging vows, a ceremony. Understand that? Good. Clear to me. I don't know why I didn't to a lot of other people that I talked to. Verse 30 forbids incest. A man shall not take his father's wife, nor uncover his father's bed. You shall not have sex with your stepmother. Which was a sin, by the way, going on in the church at Corinth. You remember Paul addressed it in 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 1 and 2. You see, not only did Israel need these laws, but they also provide a moral compass for the church today. Chapter 23 tells us, "Now he who is emasculated by crushing or mutilation shall not enter the congregation of the Lord." Now remember that the covenant God made with Israel was with Abraham and his seed. Remember that? It was a covenant inherited by birth. Thus, a eunuch, someone who had been emasculated, someone who had been crushed or mutilated, could never be a full participant in the life of the nation because he could never give birth. He could never pass on that lineage. He was limited. One of the illegitimate birth shall not enter the congregation of the Lord. Even to the 10th generation, none of his descendants shall enter the congregation of the Lord. 10 generations of blood had to flow to make him a legitimate heir. An Ammonite or Moabite shall not enter the congregation of the Lord, even to the 10th generation. None of his descendants shall enter the congregation of the Lord forever, because they did not meet you with bread and water on the road when you came out of Egypt, and because they hired against you Balaam. You remember old Balaam, the son of Beor, a greedy guy, from Pethor of Mesopotamia to curse you. The 10th generation rule applied to mixed marriages with Gentiles, except for Ammonites and Moabites. Because they hired Balaam to curse Israel, they were cursed forever. Nevertheless, the Lord your God would not listen to Balaam, but the Lord your God turned the curse into a blessing for you because the Lord your God loves you. And you remember the story, Numbers chapters 23 and 24, four times Balaam, the soothsayer, tried to open his mouth to utter a curse on Israel, and each time God changed his curse into a blessing. He couldn't curse Israel even when he tried. God turned the tables on him, and you know, God is still good at turning the tables on his enemies. You recall Joseph, what he said to his brothers. As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good. So if someone is after you tonight, hey, take heart. God is good at turning the tables on our enemies. Now God says of these Ammonites and Moabites, you shall not seek their peace nor their prosperity all your days forever. Evidently, the permanent restrictions on Moabites applied only to the men, because later we'll find that Moabite women were allowed to marry Israelis and become citizens. Ruth was a Moabitess, and she became the great-grandma of someone very famous, King David, right? Verse 7, you shall not abhor an Edomite, for he is your brother. You remember the Edomites were descendants of Esau, Isaac's son, Jacob's brother. You shall not abhor an Egyptian, because you were an alien in his land. The children of the third generation born to them may enter the assembly of the Lord. Now the next few laws apply to cleanliness and sanitation. When the army goes out against your enemies, then keep yourself from every wicked thing. If there is any man among you who becomes unclean by some occurrence in the night, then he shall go outside the camp. He shall not come inside the camp, but it shall be when evening comes that he shall wash with water, and when the sun sets, he may come into the camp. He was subject to a temporary quarantine. Also, you shall have a place outside the camp where you may go out, and you shall have an implement among your equipment. And when you sit down outside, I'm sorry, but this is funny. You're supposed to have an implement among your equipment. And when you sit down outside, you shall dig with it and turn and cover your refuse. Now, this is for the man who's in the middle of battle, and if he needs to relieve himself, he's to go outside of the camp, and when he's done, he's to turn over his business with a shovel. You know, kind of bury it. And I love the reason we're given for why he should leave no chip unturned. Verse 14, for the Lord your God walks in the midst of your camp. The Lord doesn't want to step on it. Turn it over with your shovel. For the Lord your God walks in the midst of your camp to deliver you and give your enemies over to you. Therefore your camp shall be holy, that he may see no unclean thing among you and turn away from you. Verse 15. You shall not give back to his... I bet you didn't know that was in the Bible, did you? Verse 15. You shall not give back to his master the slave who has escaped from his master to you. Now, I think this is kind. You don't give back the runaway. Obviously, he may have been abused, probably was misused. You don't give him back. There was a reason he ran away. Masters were supposed to be kind and benevolent toward their slaves in Israel. He may dwell with you in your midst, in the place which he chooses within one of your gates, where it seems best to him. You shall not oppress him. Now there shall be no ritual harlot of the daughters of Israel or a perverted one of the sons of Israel. The ritual harlots were temple prostitutes, and in idolatrous lands, there were women who sold sex to raise funds for the priest in the temple of their idol, the ritual harlots. A perverted one was a homosexual prostitute. We're told you shall not bring the wages of a harlot or the price of a dog, which was another way of referring to the proceeds of this male prostitution. It's interesting, the price of a dog, to the house of the Lord your God for any vowed offering, for both of these are an abomination to the Lord your God. You shall not charge interest to your brother, interest on money or food or anything that is lent out at interest. Don't make a profit off your brother. It's what the Gentiles are for. What's the old joke? You know why God created the Gentiles? Somebody's got to pay retail. To a foreigner, you may charge interest, but to your brother, you shall not charge interest, that the Lord your God may bless you in all to which you set your hand in the land which you are entering to possess. Now, when you make a vow to the Lord your God, well, you did it when you got married. You shall not delay to pay it, for the Lord your God will surely require it of you, and it would be sin to you. But if you abstain from vowing, it shall not be a sin to you. Or as Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verse 5 puts it, better not to vow than to vow and not pay. That which is gone from your lips you shall keep and perform, for you voluntarily vowed to the Lord your God, which you have promised with your mouth. Be a man of your word. Be a woman of your word. And you'll be a witness for Jesus Christ. Now, when you come into your neighbor's vineyard, you may eat your fill of grapes at your pleasure, but you shall not put any in your container. When you come into your neighbor's standing grain, you may pluck the heads with your hand, but you shall not use a sickle on your neighbor's standing grain. In other words, this was a kindness to the traveler. You know, you're passing through the vineyard, grab you a few grapes, pass into the grain field, grab you some grain, you know, some little grounded up wheat for you, some refreshment along the way. This was a courtesy to the traveler. This did not allow a bum to camp out in your vineyard or in your wheat field and mooch off of you all the time. Now, in Deuteronomy chapter 24, God regulates divorce. But understand up front, just because God regulated divorce doesn't mean he ever approved of it. In fact, Malachi chapter 2, verse 16 makes it crystal clear. The Lord God of Israel says that he hates divorce. Don't ever doubt what God's attitude toward divorce is. He hates it. For it covers one's garment with violence. That's interesting. Malachi considers divorce a violent act, and indeed it is. In fact, the Hebrew word for divorce implies an amputation. The root word means a hewing off or a cutting apart. C.S. Lewis made an interesting observation about divorce. He said, Christians all regard divorce as something like cutting up a living body, as a kind of surgical operation. Some think that the operation is so violent that it cannot be done at all. Others admit that it is a desperate remedy in extreme cases. They are all agreed that it is more like having your legs cut off than it is like dissolving a business partnership. Indeed, that's true. God hated divorce. It was a violent act. It tore apart a union between two people. And thus, this law in chapter 24 is an attempt by God to curb divorce and to promote marriage. What it did was formalize a procedure that made a divorce more difficult to obtain and therefore discouraged it. He says, when a man takes a wife and marries her, and it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some uncleanness in her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce, puts it in her hand, and sends her out of his house. Now, prior to this law, all you had to do to divorce your wife was just say, bye-bye, honey. That was it. But notice what he does here. Now you have to obtain a certificate, which would force you to visit the elders of the city. This also would create a cooling off period. It would also require public exposure of your deeds. Now the person seeking the divorce has to think, well, maybe the problems can be worked out after all. Does this person really want the public humiliation of admitting to a failed marriage? Now all of a sudden he has to think through these things. Because of the time delay, rash judgments will now be avoided. Verse 2, when she has departed from his house and goes and becomes another man's wife, if the latter husband detests her and writes her a certificate of divorce, puts it in her hand and sends her out of the house, or if the latter husband dies who took her as his wife, then her former husband who divorced her must not take her back to be his wife after she has been defiled, for that is an abomination before the Lord, and you shall not bring sin on the land which the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance. See, here's a second way that this law discouraged divorce. All divorces in Israel were permanent. Divorce your spouse, and you can't change your mind. Not next month, not next year, not in the next 20 years. Again, this was an attempt to discourage divorce. This was to cause you to think seriously about initiating the divorce in the first place. Several months ago, Glenn Wolfe died in a Los Angeles nursing home. Glenn was 88 years old. And though he had left behind several children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, no one came to claim his body. The city of Los Angeles paid for him to be buried in an unmarked grave. But what made Glenn's case so unusual was that he was a world record holder. The Guinness Book of World Records recognized Glenn as the most married man. Glenn Wolfe had been married and divorced 29 times. 29 times. Can you imagine? Can you imagine what were the women, what were the 21 and 22 and 23 gals thinking? What stuns me about this is here was a man who spent his whole life looking for love and sought to find it by changing wives, changing situations. And yet in the end, because he didn't stick with anyone, there was no one who loved him enough to even give him a decent burial. I hope you'll consider that divorce may not be the answer after all. That if you're looking for love, it might be best found by sticking with the one you got. Working it out. Resolving your problems. Being committed. These are the seeds of love. Let me encourage you. Love the one you got. Verse 5. When a man has taken a new wife, he shall not go out to war or be charged with any business. He shall be free at home 1 year and bring happiness to his wife whom he has taken. A newlywed was allowed a whole year off from military duty or from any kind of civil service to focus on his marriage, to build a good foundation. I think what he's saying is that the best way to protect against divorce is to strengthen marriages. That should be our strategy as well. He says, no man shall take the lower or the upper millstone in pledge, for he takes one's living in pledge. In other words, without two millstones, you can't produce grain, you can't grind the grain, you can't feed yourself. No bread, you don't eat. And so don't take a man's livelihood as collateral. Then he can't feed himself to make the money to pay you back. If a man is found kidnapping any of his brethren of the children of Israel and mistreats him or sells him, then that kidnapper shall die, and you shall put away the evil from among you. In ancient times, people were seldom abducted and then held for ransom. Usually the captives were sold into slavery. For example, Joseph. Verse 8, take heed in an outbreak of leprosy, that you carefully observe and do according to all that the priests, the Levites, shall teach you, just as I commanded them, so you shall be careful to do. Remember what the Lord your God did to Miriam on the way when you came out of Egypt. You remember that story. Numbers chapter 12. Miriam was Moses' sister, and she rebelled against her brother's authority, and in response, God struck her with leprosy.
The book of Deuteronomy might sound like a boring, stuffy Old Testament book, but the truth is, there are so many good things to glean from this book. Moses wrote this book of the Bible, and he was giving the Israelites some basic advice to live on. In Deuteronomy 30, 19 and 20, he says, choose life, that both you and your descendants may live, that you may love the Lord your God, that you may obey his voice, and that you may cling to him, for he is your life and the length of your days. What an inspiring and wise thing for Moses to share with the people. Did you realize that living for God is a choice? There may come trials and difficulties from following Jesus, but it's still a choice that you're making for ultimate life with Jesus. It's worth it. So take this advice for yourself today. Choose life with Jesus. Maybe you've yet to make this choice. We would like to help walk you through that decision. We could be reached at 770-736-2828. That's 770-736-2828. We're here for you and are happy to pray with you and answer hard questions you might have. If you'd like to hear this teaching again or listen to other messages by Pastor Sandy, just visit our website at sandyadams.org. We're so glad you tuned in today. We hope you'll join Pastor Sandy next time on Sandy Adams Radio.